Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm very well. How are you today?
I'm great. I'm great indeed. I want to talk about something that we're doing at the restaurant, something that's wound up being a tremendous success, is two things that have come together. One is that we are now using in the spring many of the fruits that we put up in the fall, mm-hmm. or in the summer and the fall of last year. And this was our diabolical plan all along, as we put up fruits and vegetables for the ability to use them now. So, of course, everybody knows that Catherine Lombardi, we put up summer tomatoes mm-hmm. for use throughout the year. And throughout the year, there's actually one canned tomato that we like, that we use a certain percentage of that in our mm-hmm. our final tomato sauce. But most of our sauce is our own San Marzano tomatoes that we put up 8,000 pounds. This year we'll put up 10,000 pounds of in the fall. But we also put up
various fruits.
And here's the thing. This time of year, everybody, in the spring,
the weather's starting to change, and people are feeling like they want to change their eating habits. They're tired of eating. You know, a lot of the things that we eat in the winter time that we think of when we think of winter are root vegetables and mushrooms and those kinds of foods. And when spring arrives, we want to see a different color palette of foods.
Well, but the idea is, you know, we don't grow up on farms anymore, so we don't understand exactly the nature of things. We think, oh, it's spring, let's go and have spring foods. Well, the spring foods, or the summer foods, the stuff out of the ground, yeah, it's not grown yet, okay? Because the thing about nature is, it's not like you wake up one morning and, oh, the corn is ready.
What a lot of people don't realize is that certainly with our fruits, well, first we have flowers.
Okay. We're in the flower stage right now.
We're just beginning the flower stage, and then we have fruits.
So, you know, you'll see early things. The early fruits you'll see strawberries early, mm-hmm. and we can't wait for that period of time. But right now we have fiddlehead ferns, mm-hmm. which are the harbingers of spring. We do not yet have spring onions. What do we do? How do we satisfy this? You know, people come into the restaurant and people, you know, come into your house and say, we want the summer stuff. We want the spring stuff. Well, this is, and they say that, you know, April is the cruelest month mm-hmm. Because we're looking for the foods of summer, but we don't have them yet. But we have them from last year. And we put this stuff up for right now. And the fruits we generally put up in alcohol. We put them up in alcohol and sugar. So I have sugar plums that we put up in Cointreau. Mm-hmm. We have cherries, different kinds of cherries, red and yellow, that we put up in brandy and maraschino.
Some delicious apples and pears, and just really some great stuff from the height of the season last year.
So this stuff is appearing on our menu now, and it's a wonderful thing. We have a friend, a guy named, I don't think he'll mind me using his name, he's Dr. Harold Connolly. He's one of the foremost experts on meteorites. He's a geologist in the world, but he was a young bartender when we were young bartenders, and he used to, and his family was in the candy business for generations. Mm-hmm. So he used to, every Christmas, give us these things, these fruits that he'd put up in alcohol in the fall, and they were wonderful Christmas presents. They were some of the best Christmas presents I ever got. We would look forward to them every year. And so we had Harold in our kitchen over the last couple of years helping us perfect these recipes, and they're amazing. The problem is, commercially, when you put up alcohol and fruit and alcohol, and it's a little more complex than just putting something up in, you know, like you're canning something, it's quite expensive, mm-hmm. especially if you use good alcohol like Cointreau, which is $30 a bottle.
Right. Canning something when we're canning tomatoes, for instance, the primary expense is in the tomato.
Right.
When we start canning things that are up in alcohol, the fruit becomes not very important to the overall
cost. Because it's the height of the season, and
sure,
sugar plums
what
are cheap.
What if five or six pears cost you in the middle of pear season? Not very much. Well, what does a liter of Cointreau cost you?
$30, $40, $50. Well, so what we've done is, the way that we figured this out last year was the only way that this could make sense. I mean, I can't get a quart of nectarines, for example, which we put up in Cointreau, which is a good, mm-hmm. which is a, this is a real thing. I can't have that quart of product cost me $65 wholesale, plus I have to hold on to it for 7 months before I can sell it, how could I ever put it on the plate? I'd have to charge $1 million for the currently we have some foie gras with the nectarines that we put up in Cointreau and star anise and sweet spices and some other stuff. It becomes,
the nectarines are really delicious.
They're amazing.
Let me tell you, it would be worth the $65 if just for the nectarines.
But, you know, we're expensive. We're not that expensive. So, but the way that we decided to make it work, or the way we figured out to make it work, is to, again, utilize a whole product, which is another principle we talk about in restaurants all the time. And now what I have left after I take those nectarines out is I have 600 milliliters or 750 milliliters, maybe a little more than the bottle of Cointreau I started with. Now with the nectarine juice and all in there, I have about a bottle and a half of Cointreau infused for 6 months with nectarines and star anise and all this stuff. I make that into a cocktail, and that becomes the primary ingredient of a cocktail. And now I can serve the peaches on the foie gras for a reasonable price because I can also charge $10 for a drink we've invented. Mark and I invented it called the Redheaded Stepchild because it's red and it's the leavings of the liquid left over from the nectarines in the jar, and it's about 50%. The nectarine Cointreau star anise juice and 50% tequila, a silver tequila. We picked just the right tequila, and it's a beautiful, beautiful drink.
And the drink is spectacular, but it's got all this infusion. Now, again, like anything else that we do, we want one and one to equal three. So we take this beautiful nectarine, and it adds things, it becomes this new thing from all the spices that we put in it and the Cointreau. But it also is giving something out of itself into that liquid, and that liquid becomes really special and really interesting at the same time. And we've created two products that are better than they were before the process started.
And the other thing is we're being able to eat locally and drink locally. I mean, we can sort of address the summer. Now, there are no local nectarines in March, April, May, or June, but you can have our local nectarines on the plate and in the glass, which lets us, just keep true to our principles all year round. And this is a new thing we've been experimenting with for years, but we're wholeheartedly involved in now. And it's also something that you can do at home. There are lots of ways to preserve as we go into the summer. You've got to plan a little bit, but it's a lot of fun if you want to take a Saturday. You need to read up on things. You need to be very safe because you don't want botulism forming in your jars. You need to be able to either have a pressure canner, which is just a cooker to just heat what goes in the can. You need to be very careful about keeping things sterile. And you need to be very careful about making sure you have the right acidity level and the sweetness level. But it's a really fun thing that you can do at home and then either give away as gifts or, and again, when it seems very expensive, as long as you utilize that whole product, you yourself can make a cocktail out of what's left or use what's left as an ingredient in a soup or something else. Then it makes sense to do.
And I'll tell you what's going to happen is for us, a drink like the Redheaded Stepchild is also going to become a seasonal cocktail.
Right.
Because simply we won't be able to produce enough for us to use 12 months a year.
Right. Of course not.
And we'll be using the fresh nectarines and things like that in cocktails when nectarines are in season again later this year. And the Redheaded Stepchild will be back again next year when it's time, when the fresh products aren't available.
And this is where restaurants are going. This is where food is going in the United States. And the other nice thing is we bought those nectarines from a local farmer who's a friend of ours, and it keeps it all in the family. And the mason jars are reusable, not the lids, but the rings are. Mm-hmm. And it's exciting. It lets us, you know, it used to be that we'd say, okay, well, wait until August, till the harvest month, and that would be exciting. This is a way to keep it exciting all year round. It's a way to mark time. It's a way to mark the change of the seasons. We'll be back in just a moment. And if you want to try Redheaded Stepchild, come on to the cocktail bar, Catherine Lombardi, and you can sample one for yourself. And then the big thing is to make one at home next year. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Our guest today is Will Allen. He co-manages the Organic Cedar Circle Farm in Vermont, and he's author of a book called The War on Bugs, an expose of the fertilizer and pesticide industry. He's a doctor of anthropology, an ex-marine, and a civil rights activist, and he joins us today to talk about his new book.
Will Allen, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
The War on Bugs. I really like the title.
Yeah.
Fascinating book, I have to say. It makes some great points. It's a very important book, but it's also a tremendous read, chock full of old advertisements and graphics, and it's really about the history of the pesticide and fertilizer industry, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and the idea was to try to tell it in their words, so that I tried to use editorials and advertisements, so that it wasn't just like a discussion on my part or anyone else's part about what they did. It shows the advertisements and the editorials and the promotional campaigns that they conducted over the last 150 years.
So it's a very readable and interesting book in that way, but because you've kind of put these graphics in here, and the way you tell the story really gives us an opportunity to kind of take it all in and go through the historical background here without it being a textbook.
Well, I hope that worked. That
now,
was our goal.
Now, talk about the genesis of the pesticide industry. We sort of started with arsenic, right?
Well, yeah, we started with arsenic, but we really started with waste industrial products. And, you know, a lot of the largest farmers initially in the United States were aristocratic farmers that had large estates that they grew a wide variety of crops on, but mostly corn and tobacco and hemp and cotton. And most of that product was shipped back to the east and to, you know, the crown countries. And so what happened is the land started petering out in the 1800s, in the early 1800s, and people were starting to freak out about what kind of farm systems they needed to deal with this fertility and pest crisis that they, you know, encountered by the early 1800s. And so a lot of farmers developed fourfold systems of rotation and composting and cover crops and, you know, a lot of the same kind of systems that we have today in the organic.
Yeah, I was
industry.
Going to say, a lot of those systems really work. They
a
work
lot
very
of
well.
Systems really work very well, right? And so there was a big push to do that, but there were also these mountainous piles of industrial waste that were building up. And the communities adjacent to those industrial waste said, look, you got to get rid of this stuff because kids are dying, you know, from playing in these piles, and it's going into the rivers, and it's going into the lakes, and, you know, you have to deal with this industrial waste, and the way they dealt with it is they dumped it on the food system, first in the form of potash, and then in the form of arsenic and lead and sulfuric acid and mercury, and, you know, basically started around the 1850s with potash, and then the 1860s with arsenic, 1890s with lead, and it's just been this plethora of industrial waste that has been dumped on our food supply for the last 150 years.
Not unlike what we did with fluoride in the water system.
Exactly, and like fluorine was like one of the major pesticides of the 30s, and, you know, it's still sold today.
Now, here's a question for you. How did they convince farmers, and was it at all a good idea? Did it work? Was it efficacious to use this stuff in moderation on crops to control bugs without having it get into the food supply?
Well, you know, the big thing was that most of the farms in those days and today are controlled by large-scale agricultural interests. And those large-scale agricultural interests at that time were also the investors in the new industry, right? So the industrial waste belonged to those large-scale farmers in many cases. And what they did is they sent like 40 of their best chemistry students to Europe to study with Justice von Liebig and Johnson and a few other people that were promoting the use of chemicals in agriculture, saying that one chemical is the same as another chemical. Nitrogen dug up from the ground is the same as nitrogen you get from animal manures, which was totally bogus, of course, but that was the science of the day. And that's what they did, is they kept pushing that science onto the public, saying, look, this is safe. This is, you know, this is going to make your bottom line really profitable. And then you can use these chemicals and feel safe that, one, you're going to be a profitable farm, and, two, you know, it's not going to hurt you in any way because you're using it in minuscule quantities, right?
Sounds very much like the science of today.
Exactly. It's the same, you know, nobody tested anything. Nobody did any analysis of it, and it was just foisted off on the public. The public became the guinea pig, and by the turn of the century, there was a huge anti-pesticide movement that had developed.
Actually, you know, we need to take a quick break, but we'll be back in just a moment talking more with Will Allen about his book, The War on Bugs, A History of the Pesticide and Fertilizer Industry. Fascinating stuff. Back in just a moment. 1450 WCTC, it's 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick. And its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. We're talking with Will Allen. His book is The War on Bugs. It's a history of the pesticide and fertilizer industry. I wanted to ask you, Will, what is the, you talked about how back when we started to in fertilizers specifically, the way this started was we convinced farmers, or the fertilizer industry convinced farmers that nitrogen from composting and from manure was the same as nitrogen from industrial waste. Why wasn't it, and how is it different, and how is it harmful?
Well, what happens is the nitrogen that they put on from, that they sucked out of the atmosphere, or that came from industrial waste, was put on at a very high rate, and that high rate had a dramatic effect on the soil microorganisms. Well, you know, at some point we need to understand that, like, if you look at a piece of soil, it's pretty much the same as looking at a piece of you. I mean, like, very little of us is alive, very little of the soil is alive. But the most important things that are alive in us are our microorganisms, our intestinal bacteria, and our viruses that exist in our system and are functional in our system. Those same viruses and bacteria and fungi and earthworms are critical in soil health as well, because what they do is they eat up materials, and then their waste material becomes our main source of fertilizer.
And when we use a carpet pesticide to kill everything in the soil, we don't just kill the bad stuff, we also kill the good stuff.
We also kill the good stuff. So most of our soil that is on these factory farms is dead soil. I mean, there have been times where I've taken over farms that were chemically managed and switched them over to organic. And in the case of the farm we just took over, it's 55 acres, and in the first year or two, we didn't find any earthworms. I mean, no earthworms.
You know, it's funny. If you want to listen to some of our back shows out in the listening audience, you can go to our show with Barbara Shin, who has a vineyard on Long Island that she farms is basically a meadow. And we compare that with the dirt. It's not even soil. It's just dirt because it's dead. On a neighboring farm that's chemically managed, and, you know, it's dead. You can knock on it like a door, you know.
Right.
When we come back after the news, we're going to talk more with Will Allen about the history of the pesticide industry and this wonderful, weird subject to say this about, but it was wonderful and interesting and colorful book about a very important part of American history. Back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 1130.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
We're talking today with Will Allen. He is the co-manager of Cedar Circle Farm in Vermont. His book is The War on Bugs. It's a wonderful book. You can find out more about it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and even click right on through and buy it. Will, we were talking before the show about fertilizer, but let's go back to pesticides for a moment. You state in your book that a large part of the American public at one time was suffering from a degree of arsenic poisoning because of this.
Right. Well, during the 30s, there were several muckraker books that were written that followed in that tradition of the muckraker book that had been written in 1906 by Upton Sinclair called The Jungle, which was an expose of the meatpacking industry, and we know we have serious problems with the meatpacking industry today. They just dumped 140 million pounds of beef. And so the same kind of thing was going on then, but during the 30s, a group of people got together that ultimately became the Consumers Reports and the Consumers Union, and they wrote three books. One of the books was 100 Million Guinea Pigs, which was the story of how people had been guinea pigged into accepting arsenic and lead on their food, and, you know, the chemical companies fighting for that arsenic and lead to stay on their food. And then the second book was Eat, Drink, and Be Wary. That was written in 1935. And then in 1937, a book was written called 40 Million Guinea Pig Babies. And all, because that's how many babies there were in the United States at that time. And in 1933, when 100 million guinea pigs were written, that's how many people there were in the United States then. So everybody was really a guinea pig, and the population was suffering from lead poisoning and arsenic poisoning.
Unbelievable.
At a very high rate. And a lot of people don't even know this history. They think that environmentalism started with Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. And the struggle against these pesticides is much older.
I'm going to tell you, I'm a firm believer that my guinea pigs should be guinea pigs.
Yeah,
exactly.
Now, were people actually showing the signs of lead poisoning or of arsenic poisoning, and what kinds of signs were they showing, and where can we find this information to back up that claim?
Well, you can look in 100 Million Guinea Pigs. Those are books that are still on library shelves, and Eat, Drink, and Be Wary is there, and all of these are cited in the book, and so is 40 Million Guinea Pig Babies. And what people were seeing is an enormous amount of dyspepsia from lead poisoning and arsenic poisoning, because initially they had used arsenic and lead as medicines. And people were afraid of them as medicines, and by the Civil War, people had stopped using arsenic and lead as medicines on a large scale, but it was still the final solution if you had syphilis, for example. And you see in Out of Africa, Meryl Streep's character took Salvarsan, which was arsenic.
And arsenic is a final solution for syphilis. It really works.
If you
get rid of it forever when you're dead.
Right.
Well, 50% of the people were cured, 50% were killed.
Wow.
You know, and so, I mean, but 50% were cured. That was the advertisement. You know? So, okay, 50% die.
Yeah,
and the same thing happened with food. I mean, people were told, look, we have to have this on the food because we have such a huge pest problem, right? Well, you know, the U.S. was the last country in the world to regulate arsenic and lead. All the other countries of the world had regulated arsenic and lead to a very small percentage of residues that were on the food, but the U.S. fought it. And they, you know, we still have arsenic as a legal pesticide today. It's used as an herbicide in cotton and corn, and it's used as a major herbicide on all the lawn products. Like, say, for example, if you're going to buy sod from a sod growing company, that's going to have a lot of arsenic on it. All of our football fields and baseball fields have a lot of arsenic as a pesticide.
So if you buy sod and you put it in your front yard right next to your garden where you plant your tomatoes, that's probably not a great thing, right?
Not a great thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Crazy.
I mean, grow it up with grass, put a little bit of straw over it, and you've got a great lawn. You know, come on.
I have always thought that it was short-sighted of us to spray things onto our fruits and vegetables and things that we eat, and to think that kill bugs that are designed to eradicate some form of bug or another, and to think that it would have no impact on us when we ate it.
Yeah.
That would be short-sighted, that there's something just flawed about that thinking.
You know, there's a great discussion. I wonder if this is something we talk about a lot on the show. And again, Will's book is The War on Bugs. You should pick it up. It's a really entertaining read, believe it or not, although the subject is quite disturbing. But to go back and listen to our shows, the Shin Vineyards on Long Island. We did a series with them. We talked about their soil and how they grow things. It's harder somewhat to grow organically, but you just need to be smarter about it. But one of the things that David said to me, and David was a chef, they owned a restaurant in New York for a long time, but he said, you know, on my farm, the goal is, I'm not even going for organic certification, but there's nothing I put on the food, that on the grapes that I'm going to make into wine for you, that would kill my dog if he ate it.
Right.
And it's very hard to find that on a conventional farm today. In fact, there are obstacles to farmers who have the know-how and the ability and want to farm without pesticides. The banks put I was surprised to find in your book, and I'm pretty well read on the subject, that the banks put obstacles in a farmer's way. Can you talk to us about that?
Well, you know, for 13 years we ran the Sustainable Cotton Project, which was a project that talked Patagonia and all of the clothing companies into using organic cotton. And it also was a project that tried to help growers switch over from conventional cotton to organic cotton production, because conventional cotton production is so toxic. And, what we found out is that, growers were loath to make a change, but once they found out that there was a market, then they were not that opposed to make a change. And the other thing we found out is that growers could actually dramatically increase their bottom line if they, followed the recommendations that we gave them. So we did the same thing that the chemical companies did. The chemical companies give you a pesticide, give you a fertilizer that's new on the market for 2 or 3 years until you're hooked on it, and then they use you as an advertisement to say how great it was. Well, we followed that same program. We gave farmers for 3 years 30 acres of integrated pest management and organic advice for 3 years, and they bought into the whole organic system using the same kind of model that the chemical companies do. We didn't feel like we wanted to reinvent any wheel. And what we found out is that growers realized that the soil had changed, the biology had changed on their farm, and that they could actually do better on their farms, maybe not make quite as big a yield, but almost in every case the yield was, percentage-wise the same as the conventional yield. And they realized that those were their favorite places on the farm. Those 30 acres that we switched over first were places where more birds were around, more wildlife was around. I mean, it brought the whole life back to the farm.
Well, but don't banks lay out an obstacle for folks who want to switch over to non-use pesticides?
That was my next thing. And, like, a lot of these growers, then once they'd gotten 30 acres, they wanted to switch over 500 acres or 600 acres. Well, they went to the banks, and the bank said, look, we don't have enough actuarial data to give you a loan on organic. We can't give you a loan on organic. So a lot of these farmers had to get clothing companies and other investors to invest in their farm to get their farm loans. And the banks said, look, our big deal is the reason we make growers use pesticides and chemical fertilizers is because that protects our loan. We know that we're going to get a yield off of those farms where you use chemicals, chemical pesticides and fertilizers. And our argument was, look, we're getting as big a yield and better quality and better price, and yet they still, they were reluctant to give loans, and we fought at the banks. So, I mean, we go in with growers with all this actuarial data that we'd collected to try to support their loans, and the banks fought us all the way.
Is it changing?
It's changing because the industry has grown up. Like, we started the Sustainable Cotton Project in 1991, and the industry has finally caught up and realized, wow, this is the fastest-growing agricultural sector. Banks are a little bit less loath to give loans, but there's still some reluctance out there. And, the dominant way of farming for especially the commodity crops, corn, cotton, soy, wheat, rice, canola, you know, those crops are dominated by both genetic modification and pesticides and fertilizers, and they're all subsidized.
Well,
they're all buying those fertilizers, pesticides, and genetically modified organisms with your tax dollars.
Well, because that's the pesticide and fertilizer companies have a lot of great lobbyists. But let's just point out one thing. I want to reiterate one thing that Will just said. It's getting somewhat easier for people to do because there's a market. And there's a market because you people listening to our show have said, I want, whether it's clothing or it's food, I want stuff that's responsibly produced.
And I'll pay a little bit more for it.
And you have as much, you have the most say of all in making it known to people you buy your clothes from, people you buy your food from, that it's important to you how it's produced. Will's book is The War on Bugs. We'll be back in just a moment to talk a little bit more with him about that. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:46. I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953. Hey everybody, welcome back. It's Francis and Mark, the Restaurant Guys, talking with Will Allen about his book, The War on Bugs. Will, we were talking about how consumers can make a difference, and over the break, you and Mark and I were talking about how consumers are making a difference, especially in Europe. The consumers voting with their votes and voting with their dollars have changed the way European agriculture, or kept European agriculture from embracing the American model. You want to talk to us about that?
Yeah, you know, like what we've seen, because we've traveled a lot in Europe and traveled a lot in Asia, and the consumers are, you know, hold most of the keys. Like, my argument always is that, you know, you can change policy by, you know, like maybe half inch at a time, whereas you can change, you know, how our food system is really going to adapt to the new century, you know, dramatically by consumers making their voices heard. And that's what's happened with organic food. That's what's happened to genetic modification. A recent outpouring on the part of consumers demanding that they not be fed genetically modified milk has led to several market chains dropping genetic modified milk, and Monsanto going back to the growers and saying, look, you've got to be on our side, and you've got to send letters to all these distributors to keep genetically modified milk on the market. Well, that's a major victory, and that victory is a consumer victory.
Well, you know, and it's funny because but you have to stay vigilant. You have to listen to shows like this. You have to read the papers because in that particular example, what Monsanto is doing is they're going around the nation and convincing individual state legislatures to prohibit milk companies from putting on the label that the milk is made without their growth hormone. So you can't have in some states. You can't find milk that comes from a cow without Monsanto's
growth hormone,
recombinant bovine growth hormone.
Exactly.
So there's big money on the other side, but there are enough of us on this side that if we demand it, we can get it.
I think Francis makes a good point there. There's big money on the other side, and they're pushing very, very hard. But we're more powerful than they are as a group.
If we stay informed.
Well, and there's a lot of money on our side, don't forget, because it's consumer money.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and like if the consumers say, look, I don't want this stuff that is really, you know, it's waste material. It's like the worst stuff that you could put in your body, right? And, you know, like my argument always is like the people that come to our farm because they know that the food is clean, they know that they're going to get a quality product. And people are happy about it when they leave. People hug us. People don't hug people in, you know, in the major supermarkets. I'm sorry, they don't.
Well, let's talk about the state of modern pesticides
today.
Hold on,
I just need to interrupt for 1 second. They do hug them, but usually they're taking their wallet when
they're
Exactly.
So, but and we only have a couple minutes left, but what is the state of are modern pesticides as dangerous as the arsenic and lead that was used in days of yore?
Well, they are, really, because, like, see, the thing about that people don't really realize is that 90% of the chemicals that are used on in agriculture, in U.S. agriculture today, are nerve poisons. They're organophosphates and carbamates. And those were the anti-personnel weapons that the Germans developed during the Second World War and before the Second World War. And they're now being spread, you know, indiscriminately on all our food. And what happens is they're not contact pesticides. They're systemic pesticides. So they go right into the system of the plant. They go right into the system of the fruit or vegetable, whatever you're eating. And you can't wash them off. That's a joke on the American public that you can wash off those chemicals, because 90% of the chemicals that we use are not contact pesticides. They're systemic pesticides.
They come in through the root system.
And they're nerve poisons. Mm-hmm. They're nerve poisons. They cause serious nervous damage when they accumulate in your system.
So the idea is that what we're talking about, a systemic pesticide, is not a pesticide that we spray on the outside of the apple so when the bug lands on the apple it dies. It's a pesticide that gets into the apple so if the bug eats the apple it kills it.
Exactly.
But then we eat the apple.
We eat the apple.
Doesn't that seem wrong to you?
It seems wrong, especially when they spray apples about 20 times.
That's crazy. That's just,
a year.
Just insane. Just insane. Well, how is the book being received, The War on Bugs?
You know, I've really had good response to it, you know, and a big part of it is because, like, we have an alternative. It's not like I'm just out there shouting in the wilderness and saying, oh, this is terrible, we have a bad agricultural system. I'm saying we have a bad agriculture system, and they're really good strategies to fix it. You know, like local production for local use, know your farmer, go to farmer's market. You can get organic cheaper there than you can get it in the supermarket.
Sure.
And so our argument is, look, we already have the answers, and the people that are holding out against the answers are big agriculture and big government.
Knowledge is power. If you want to educate yourself and see the context of this whole thing, one of the best books to come around in a long time is The War on Bugs by Will Allen. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks,
Will.
Will.
I really appreciate it, you guys. Thanks a lot.
It's been a pleasure to have you. If you want to find out more about this book, you can go to our website and restaurantguysradio.com and order the book. Also, I encourage you to go back and listen to the show done with Barbara Shin and David Page of Shin Vineyards on Long Island. They're going to come to the restaurant soon and do a dinner. You can find out about that on our restaurant website, stageleft.com. And you can talk to them in person about that kind of stuff. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 1155. Hey, everybody, welcome back. It's The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. What a great show. What a great book.
Really great,
what a great
show.
Guy.
You know, I need to talk, and this is all anecdotal. It's there's no evidence here, but my own personal
experience.
Feelings and experience. I, for a long time, had no problem eating fruit as a kid, things like that, apples, pears, things like that. No trouble at all. Then I'm going to say 15 years ago or so, I began to have allergic symptoms when I ate apples and pears and things like that. A few years back, Francis and I started eating better, eating more healthily. You know, let's say 5 years ago, 6 years ago, we really got on board with this whole organic and on board with sustainable agriculture. Really, really took hold. And I'll tell you, I didn't put the two things together. I began to go back to eating pears and apples and things and said, oh, you know, that allergy must have kind of just worked its way through. And so that's basically what I've been eating is mostly organic foods or sustainably produced foods or foods that are low impact agriculture foods. And just the other day, last week, I just picked up an apple from somewhere and began to eat it. And I got all of those same reactions that I got 6, 7, 8 years ago when I was eating apples.
Supermarket apple.
Supermarket apple.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my goodness, I feel like I got nauseous. I, you know, the inside of my mouth began to itch and all these problems from these allergic problems that I thought I was past returned. And I immediately thought to myself, wow, I need to be more careful with the fruits I eat because I have no evidence other than my own empirical
Your own anecdotal evidence.
I'm sorry, my own anecdotal evidence. But it's real. I'm telling you that that apple I had a problem with, and I haven't had a problem with apples or pears in a long time.
Support your local farmers. Eat locally. Eat well. Be happy. And you check our website, Stage Left Restaurant, to find out when that Shin Vineyards dinner is. If you want to check that out, that would be a great thing to come to. And they're fabulous people to talk to. They've written some books as well. It's great. Hope you've enjoyed the hour with the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 12 noon.